everyone, and welcome back to another episode of One Health, One Community. The guest for this episode is Dr. Elphick, who has extensive knowledge of ecology and evolutionary biology. He teaches classes on conservation and is enthusiastic about staying informed on topics relating to One Health. Thank you so much for joining me today on this episode of One Health, One Community. It's so nice to get to talk to you more about One Health.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
The first question that I like to ask our guests is, what does One Health mean to you?
So that's a really good question because, you know, to be honest, it's not a term that I guess I probably have seen it before, but it's not something that's not a term I'm familiar with. So it's not something I'd really thought about very much. And so I have been thinking about it since you first emailed me, and I guess I have kind of mixed thoughts. So, you know, on one hand, it seems like an idea that's very obvious that, you know, human health and the environment and wildlife health are all kind of linked. And I guess my initial reaction was that's so obvious that it doesn't really need a label. You know, I was thinking, you know, if I were to go to my grandparents who grew up in small rural farming communities and mention that, they would be kind of, well, of course, and not even really know why we're talking about it. But then on the other hand, you know, the more I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, people's lives are very different in today. And for a lot of people, those things are very disconnected. And so I guess it's perhaps a corrective to that and a way to get people to recognize, or at least people who live busy, what we think of as modern lives, to think about connections that we just kind of take for granted and don't even pay attention to anymore.
That's a great idea. I didn't really think about how the connections have shifted over time too.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I hadn't really thought about it either. I mean, I grew up as someone who spent a lot of time outside. I've been birding since I was a little kid. And so, you know, the fact that interacting with the environment and the outdoors and thinking about those types of things has been part of my entire life. And so, but I think that that's maybe not so true for a lot of people. So,
I also wanted to ask you about which classes you teach at UConn.
Yeah, so the kind of the big one that I teach every year is Introduction to Conservation Biology, EEB 2208. And it's an environmental literacy course. And so it has a fairly diverse mix of students in it, which is kind of nice. I mean, it is fundamentally a science course though, and we focus largely on the science of conservation, although I do try to kind of make connections to other disciplines because it's very much an interdisciplinary field where, even though the core of it is about the science, you know, to go from the scientific understanding of conservation to actually putting conservation into practice, you know, you have to interact with the legal system and you interact with economics and all kinds of other kind of societal values. And so, so I do touch on a lot of those things. But it's, you know, it's fundamentally, it's a course about extinction, you know, modern extinction, not extinction that happened millions of years ago, but current rates of extinction, causes of extinction, and probably most importantly, what we can do to prevent extinctions. And I always kind of, I mean, half jokingly, although it's also true, you know, say to students, well, the first half of the course is really depressing. I'm going to tell you just how bad things are. But in the second half, we're going to focus on, you know, what we're doing about it. And hopefully that balances out the first half of the course a little bit. And then I guess the other thing I'd say about it is that, you know, even though it's really about extinction, that connects to all kinds of other things. It's, you know, I mean, it's the loss of biological diversity across the planet, but it also, that has consequences for all of the different services that we get from nature and from ecosystems that kind of provide humans with things that we need, like food and clean water. The consequences of habitat destruction, which are very much central to conservation biology, relate to all kinds of other things that affect humans, like disease spread and so on. And then, you know, we're constantly, when we're doing conservation, we're having to balance that with other human activities and human goals, like ensuring that we have enough food to feed people and things of that type. So even though it's very much about this one kind of seemingly narrow little thing, It kind of connects to all kinds of other environmental issues. And then, so that's the main course that I teach for undergrads. I also teach a couple of graduate courses in conservation biology. I have a small seminar-based course, Current Topics in Conservation, which is on a different topic every year. We do a lot of reading and discussion in class. It's aimed at graduate students, but there's usually a few undergraduates in the course, kind of seniors, and especially students. We have a joint bachelor's master's program in biodiversity and conservation biology in EEB, and it's a required course for students in that program.
That sounds like a really informative class and something that maybe students can like take the information from and like really act on it. So that sounds like a lot of really important skills for students to learn.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's a big class. It's the introduction class. It's a big class with 150 students. So, you know, that limits that in some ways, but you know, we do group projects. We spend a lot of time reading research articles and discussing them in the lecture and talking not just about the content, but about how you go about reading scientific papers. I think it's important to, even for big lecture courses, to focus on skills that people can use as scientists or as practitioners out in their careers, in addition to just learning a bunch of factual knowledge, which is not to say the factual knowledge isn't important. You have to have that as a basis, but you also have to know how to do things with it as well. So try to bring that in as well.
I agree. I think that's a unique aspect of the class that not every class gets to experience.
I hope so.
I also wanted to ask about your research and what the focus of it is.
Yeah, so I'm a conservation biologist by training. I work in a lot of different types of ecosystems, mostly in wetlands, but I've also done work in forested ecosystems and agricultural systems, although the farmland that I work on tends to be flooded farmland, so rice fields in particular. The role that they can play providing habitat for wetland species. But the bulk of the work in our research group these days is focused on coastal marshes and coastal resilience. So we're very interested in trying to understand how development along the coast, sea level rise, other changes that happen in coastal areas, how they affect coastal habitats and the wildlife that uses them. Most of my work focuses on birds. I mean, my training is in ornithology, but increasingly we study how the marsh vegetation is changing with sea level rise, because that affects the habitat that the birds use. We're just starting to study the insects in the marshes. In fact, as part of an undergraduate project, an undergraduate who just got some SURF funding will be starting some of that work this summer. And then I have collaborators in the NRE department, and we're jointly working on questions like how much carbon is stored in marshes and how does that change as the marshes change. So we're trying to broaden the perspective. And then other work that we've done in this system is kind of use it as a way to think about conservation problems more broadly. And so we've worked with social scientists to understand how the landowners in coastal areas feel about different ways of doing conservation. Because that perspective of the people who live there and own the land is important to designing conservation actions that will actually work. And similarly, we also work with people in government agencies and in nonprofit groups who are, you know, actually doing the conservation work, managing the land, doing restoration projects. And so we often partner with them, and we come in and try to do some of the scientific work to understand how well those restoration activities or those management activities are working, so that we can, you know, provide guidance and learn from the work that people are doing.
That sounds like every aspect of One Health is involved in your research.
I guess. there isn't a tangent that I'm not prepared to explore, I guess, which is a good thing and a bad thing, but it keeps life interesting.
My next question is kind of asking you about how you stay involved with new information that comes out regarding One Health. I know there's always new like scientific findings and new information. So I just wonder how you continuously learn about One Health.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading all the time. I mean, I'm reading stuff that's coming out in the scientific literature. That's largely focused on things that are closely linked to the research that I'm doing or that are relevant to the courses that I teach, because I, you know, try to keep up. You know, I mean, there's the narrow work that I actually do research on in a day-to-day, and I have to kind of know everything about that. But then more broadly, I just need to know what's going on in conservation and environmental science, because that's relevant to the teaching that I do, which is much, much, much broader. You know, I also, you know, I just try to read a lot. I mean, I read the news a lot. I read multiple news outlets. I'm a big fan of The New Yorker. I read The Economist. Those, I guess, are two of my main sources, and they just give me a broader perspective on a lot of different things that help me connect to the work that I do. You know, I mean, I'm not reading the scientific medical literature, but I read a lot of informed, well-researched journalism on that topic. So that kind of gives me a perspective on things that I'm not an expert on.
I think that's something that students can always do more of too, is just read more of things that I guess could apply to whatever they're studying and also what they find interesting, just to stay informed.
Reading more broadly, or listening to podcasts more broadly than things you're most interested in, or I don't watch much TV, but I guess watching TV or whatever, there, or going on YouTube and watching videos. I mean, those types of things that kind of extend beyond your disciplinary focus can really give you a new perspective on the discipline that you're working in, or the career that you're thinking about. And so I think just getting those different perspectives and trying to broaden your outlook a little bit is always a good thing. And again, it keeps things interesting.
My last question that I have for you is there one thing that you can suggest that listeners do to make a positive impact in relation to One Health, or maybe for students that are really interested in One Health to become further involved with it?
Yeah, so I'm going to cheat. I have kind of two things. One is a simple thing that people can do, I think, very specifically for themselves. And I bring this up not because I'm really an expert on it, but it's because it's a new resource that's available on campus. So a couple of faculty in EEB working with people elsewhere on campus have put together a website that's part of the Nature RX movement that I think is probably quite closely related to the One Health idea. You know, it's just recognizing that interacting with nature has all kinds of benefits for physical and mental health, and that the more you can get outside and just interact with the environment, it actually, it's not just that it's a fun or a good thing to do, it really has health benefits. So, like I say, there's a website on campus. If you just Google UConn Nature RX, you'll find it. And there's resources on places you can go for a walk on campus, or other types of resources. So I think that's something that might be helpful to students, especially if you're busy and you just need to get out of that dorm for half an hour and clear your head. And then the second thing I would say is perhaps me getting more in my soapbox about, I think, what everybody should be doing, which is ultimately most environmental problems revolve around the consumption of energy and other resources. The way in which we consume is very different from a few decades ago. And ultimately, all of the challenges we face revolve around that: climate change, habitat loss, biodiversity loss. And all of the repercussions those have for human society revolve around the amount of stuff we consume. So, and that can be very daunting, but because I think, no one person can do a lot, but every single person can do lots of small things. And if you can just do 10 small things every single day, and if everybody else does that, tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people do 10 small things every single day, it will add up and it will have a big effect. And so I would encourage people to do that. And, just to give an example, I was just reading an article, again, speaking of reading broadly, and this was about, the situation in Europe and the war in Ukraine and the dependence of European countries on Russian oil and gas. And this article pointed out that if everyone in Europe turned down their thermostat by just 1 or 2 degrees, it would reduce the continent's dependence on Russian oil by a tenth. And so, that's in the context of the war in Ukraine, but it applies to climate change. If everybody just turned down their thermostat a degree, we would save a lot of fuel. We would burn a lot less carbon. And if we all drove just a little bit less fast on the highway, it would have a similar effect. And so, you know, a lot of these things seem like there's nothing we can do, but these small things, if we all do them, they could have very, very big effects. So I guess that's my soapbox answer.
I think I often think about that idea of everyone kind of contributing to work towards a larger goal or mission. But I think that when you hear different statistics, like you mentioned about like turning your temperature down just a little bit, I think that really puts things into perspective.
Yeah. I have a friend who's who I was in college with. He was a college roommate of mine. He works for an environmental consulting firm, a big environmental consulting firm. And a lot of his work involves working with big companies to help them find ways to reduce their environmental impact. And he told me once that he worked for one of the big washing machine companies, trying to help them figure out how they could change their practices as a company and so on. And it turned out that the way they could have their biggest impact was just to change their washing machine's function so that they don't heat the water up quite as much. Again, you know, like a small temperature difference, but when it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of machines running, you know, every week, again, those very, very small differences can have huge impacts. And so, you know, but we all have to do our part. But if we're all prepared to do it, it's not that hard. It's not like it's going to require major lifestyle changes. So.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me more about One Health today. It was great meeting you and hearing more about your take on One Health.
Yeah, you too. Thanks again for inviting me.
Thank you all for listening, and be sure to look out for more episodes of One Health, One Community.